Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The world as we know it today changed dramatically 50 years ago in 1968. Women's rights, civil rights, the Vietnam War all combined to trigger mass demonstrations of protest in the U.S. and around the globe. Communist North Korea further asserted itself with the capture of an American intelligence ship. And we lost two vocal proponents of peace in the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and Democratic presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy. It was a year for the history books. Joining us now is retired OSU Vice President for Business and Finance, author as well of the book Ohio State University in the 60s, The Unraveling of the Old Order, William Shakerty. Welcome back, Bill.
Good morning, Ann. Glad to be here.
Also joining us by phone is Professor of History and Director of the American Studies Program at Wheaton College in Massachusetts, Alex Bloom. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Alex, you taught a first-year seminar at Wheaton detailing what happened in 1968 and its significance. So tell us, what's the headline for that class? Why 1968?
Well, 1968 is, I think, the most amazing year of the 20th century. If you literally took a calendar and just went month by month, there's some extraordinary event that happens, or more than one, every month. From January with the Tet Offensive, which explodes the whole Vietnam, sort of the idea that we were about to win, all the way through to October with the massacres in Mexico City that are around the time of the Olympics, and then finally, I guess, Nixon's election in November, which is not quite as dramatic as the other events. But you've mentioned several, the assassinations, the... And it wasn't just in the United States. It was also around the world, the Paris student, in Prague. Lots of lesser-known student eruptions all over, from Beijing to Rome to Madrid. Fascist countries, communist countries, centrist countries, Columbia University. It just explosions everywhere. The subtitle or the full title of that seminar was 1968, the year the world exploded. And I think that's an appropriate description.
Why does it still matter today? What do you tell your students, most of whom weren't even a twinkle in someone's eye at that point?
No, they're probably I can't even stretch that metaphor. Right. I mean, some about their grandparents, but I don't know.
Uh-huh.
I think we see the several things. One, some of the issues that were discussed are still relevant, not just in the sense that we're still talking about race questions, that we're still talking about the potentiality of war or struggles within the political sphere, but literally some of these things have continued on. I mean, they're not just equivalents, they're direct descendants of it, as well as I think a number of the things that the ways that these ideas interconnect reflect things that we have refined, the technological interactions that we discovered. We were able to watch the Tet Offensive on TV. We were able to, look at what was going on in ways that were much more sort of intimate and direct to the American people and to people of the world than they had been before, for example. So the beginnings of that, which we're now at a much more sophisticated place with technological and immediacy with the news and just world events.
Which, of course, is a shadow of what we experience today in terms of our daily news intake and the technology that we have. But back then, back in the day, we were literally watching the war on television. Of course, the Tet Offensive being the North Vietnamese using a national holiday to catch us unawares, that being the Tet holiday there. Everyone thought it was kind of a day off. It wasn't. It was a turning point. Bill Shakerty, OSU, Ohio State, you've written about how Ohio State fell into the mix at the time. What was happening here?
Well, prior to 1968, OSU remained relatively quiet compared to campuses elsewhere. But as 1968, as the national events of 1968 took hold here in Columbus, there started to be protests and other actions. And for the first time, you had large numbers of student protesters arrested. And you had some backlash from that, both frontlash and backlash. And in some ways, you had the seeds of the big riots that occurred in the spring of 1970 were planted in the spring of 1968. And It was an incredible period. I was here at the time, and there was a lot of history going on, and it was a real emotional roller coaster ride.
Did it feel historical at the time?
I think rather than thinking historically, you were thinking about yourself. In my case, I was all of a sudden, I thought I was going to graduate that year and go on to law school. And in February, I found out I was subject to the draft. So for me, a lot of my focus was, what was I going to do in relation to that? And that was true of a lot of OSU students at the time. I remember you didn't have the 24-hour news cycle you did then.
Right.
You know, now how you always have breaking news and a little crawler at the bottom.
Twitter, whatnot. Yeah.
The way you heard about stuff electronically then was, if you're watching TV or listening to radio or whatever it was, we interrupt this program. And boy, the minute you heard that, you kind of cringe because it was almost always bad news. So I titled the chapter in my book on 1968, Down the Rabbit Hole. Mm-hmm. It was kind of deliberate. It was like a descent into madness and disorder. And a lot of things came out of that that still influence today. It was an incredible period, but it wasn't necessarily fun at the time.
It wasn't a happy time. No. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're looking back to 1968, a turning point for the country, for the world. My guest, Bill Schicurti, retired OSU Vice President for Business and Finance and author of the book Soldiering On in a Dying War, The True Story of the Firebase Pace Incidents and the Vietnam Drawdown. Also, the book Ohio State University in the 60s, The Unraveling of the Old Order. Also with us, Alex Bloom. He's a history professor and director of the American Studies program at Wheaton College in Massachusetts, where he teaches a course entitled 1968, The Year the World Exploded. If you have a question or comment, we'd love to hear from people about your memories of 1968. What struck you? How did it touch you? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Alex Bloom, you researched and studied 1968. I always ask this, what surprised you? What did you think you knew about that year that caught you unawares?
Well, I think what I alluded to before, I remember it as well as Bill does. I mean, and it does seem it wasn't historically momentous. It just seemed like it was the culmination of so many things all coming, as you said in the intro, to a head all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what surprised me was the way there was this interrelationship, not just within the United States among the movements, but around the world. I discovered that, for example, that the young people in Prague, a lot of their reformistic ideas came not from listening to Radio Free Europe or American government broadcasts, but they could get West German radio. So they were listening to the Beatles and they were listening to the Rolling Stones, and they had some sense of what was going on in the West, or that the leader of the French student movement, Daniel Cohn-Bendit, said at one point, I knew the leaders of the Columbia strike, not personally, but I knew them from television. That all of a sudden, as you said, there was this interconnection between events, and you didn't find out as immediately as you find out now, but you found out within a day or so, and the footage was all on television and it was all broadcast around the world. So the relationship among these things, even things that seemed further apart, mm-hmm. were much more connected than I think I understood.
The world got smaller.
A lot. And in ways that we understand now, but I'm not sure we understood quite it was getting as smaller. I mean, the Tet Offensive footage that we talked about before, it took 24 hours to get to America. The famous scene of the Saigon police chief shooting the Viet Cong prisoner, which won the Pulitzer Prize as a photograph, but that was on TV within 24 hours of it happening. Nothing out of World War II, for example, got anywhere near that quickly to the American people.
Of course, now it would be within seconds, if not minutes,
exactly,
if not seconds.
Exactly.
Yeah. The North Korea summit is tomorrow. They had a bad rub with the United States back in 68 when they captured the American surveillance ship, the USS Pueblo. It often is overlooked. I remember, though, that was such a big, hairy deal. Bill Schicurti, what was going on around that?
Well, I think the resonance of that was the North Koreans went and took, it was a spy ship, but yeah. It was international waters, and they wouldn't give it back. And there didn't seem to be anything the United States could do about it. And at the same time, we were stuck in a stalemate in Vietnam. So I think there was a feeling, particularly among older people who had been through World War II, is what had happened to America? We used to be able to call the shots. Now these third-rate powers are sticking their tongues out at us, and there's nothing we can do. And that set off a very strong reaction, which I think Richard Nixon was very skillful, and George Wallace, in exploiting in wanting a stronger, more muscular foreign policy.
Hmm. Alex Bloom, how does the Pueblo figure in your story?
Well, it figures in some sense, not as, I mean, everything that Bill says is absolutely correct about that. And let me just say that, you know, we're still thinking about how are these third-rate powers pushing us around. I think when we hear Make America Great Again, that's embedded, that's all a big piece of that, that they don't respect us. And it begins absolutely at this point with the North Koreans, especially with the Vietnamese and others around the world not respecting us. The other thing it fits in is that when the Tet Offensive, which wasn't only this surprise, but it was at a point when Americans thought, as Westmoreland, the American commander, had said, we had hit a crossover point. We were on the downside of the hill. We were about to win. Johnson said so in his State of the Union address. Mm-hmm. And the issue with the North Koreans was actually more prominent in the newspapers with our foreign policy questions than Vietnam was in January. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden the Tet Offensive pushes everything out of that zone off the front page.
It feels like we never thoroughly trusted our government again.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I tell my students this all the time. There's this, the Gallup, I think it was Gallup, one of the good survey polling things, used to ask a question about, do you trust the American government? All the time, most of the time, some of the time, none of the time. And in the 1950s, up until about 1962 or 63, it was about two-thirds or 75% of the American people trusted the government all the time or most of the time. That number declined dramatically over the next 10 years to where it was down in the 30% by the end of the Vietnam War and Watergate, and it never really has gone back up.
Yeah,
that's even the most shocking thing. It's a little bit after 9/11, but just very temporarily. Mm. It's, you know, good times, bad times, Republicans, Democrats, doesn't matter. American people changed overwhelmingly with trusting the government.
Yeah, if I can build on that, I think that is one of the most significant legacies out of the 60s. And it was not just the government. It was also the press, the military. Universities saw a total flip. And except for maybe the military, most of these institutions have never recovered from the loss of confidence that occurred in that period.
That's true. And I think the military, it's a different sense of loss of confidence. I mean, we still, you know, applaud the military, but, you know, we're not really sure they're quite doing the job they're supposed to be doing. They're not winning, you know, which is what the military was supposed to have done in American history for 200 years.
We are talking about 1968. What do you remember? What do you want to talk about yourself? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You just heard from Alex Bloom. He's a historian and director of the American Studies Program at Wheaton College in Massachusetts, where he teaches a course on 1968. Also with us, Bill Shakurdy. He's a retired OSU vice president for business and finance, and he's also the author of the book Ohio State University in the 60s, The Unraveling of the Old Order. More coming up. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Today we're talking about the year 1968 and its indelible mark in the history books. It was a year of triumph and tragedy and also tremendous loss. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis. The night he was murdered, Democratic presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy announced the news to a crowd in Indianapolis, speaking to the peace and equality the late Reverend preached.
What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black.
2 months later, Kennedy was also gunned down by an assassin. Still with us is retired OSU Vice President for Business and Finance and author of the book, Ohio State University in the 60s, The Unraveling of the Old Order, Bill Schicurti. Also with us by phone, Professor of History and Director of the American Studies Program at Wheaton College in Massachusetts, Alex Bloom. And joining us now by phone is Associate Professor in the School of International Service at American University and author of Police Power and Race Riots, Urban Unrest in Paris and New York, Kathy Schneider. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
That night that Robert Kennedy spoke, it's been said that his words prevented riots from occurring, but calm crowds in the face of such news was not the norm by 1968, right, Kathy Schneider?
Right. I would say that Indianapolis and New York City were the exceptions. Robert Kennedy for Indianapolis and Mayor Lindsay for New York both took actions that kept people calm by showing great respect and concern for the community, acting as true leaders, not rejecting the politics of police repression, and instead talking to people's pain and empowering people.
Which calmed them.
Yes. So in Robert Kennedy's case, everybody knew that how much he had suffered with the death of his brother. In fact, that's what he pointed out. He says, I know how you're feeling. I felt the same way when my brother was killed by a white man. And then he talked about Aeschylus, about pain falling drop by drop upon the heart until in one's own despair against one's will comes wisdom. And the crowd, they said you could have heard a pin drop. People were transfixed. He understood, and everyone knew he understood what that pain was. And so it was quiet in Indianapolis. In New York, Mayor Lindsay walked through the streets because he had already created a different relationship between the community and the police in New York, in which he had come to the conclusion during the Kerner Commission work, where he was vice chairman, that what sparked riots was a toxic relationship between police and community. And he had ensured that his police would never use violence, that they would have support from the rest of the police before they would engage unless somebody's life was in danger. And he had also created task forces to allow people within the community to feel that they had a stake and control in government.
A man way ahead of his time.
Lindsay was way ahead of his time. And unfortunately, much of what Lindsay did was reversed by subsequent mayors. But it actually had a long-lasting effect on the city because young people who had been in those task forces, hired as peacemakers, as community communications liaisons, went on to become community activists. And they re-knit the fabric of these neighborhoods, and they created organizations that addressed issues of police violence nonviolently and continue to do so today.
Bill Schicurti, after after the assassination of Martin Luther King, what was happening on the Ohio State campus?
Well, in the immediate aftermath, that was the day afterwards, is when a history professor burned his draft card in class, and in a protest against the violence of that. And so that created a major campus controversy. A lot of the students, and I was one of the students in his second class, felt that he was making a statement against violence, but the trustees and others felt he was violating federal law, and therefore he was fired. So that created a controversy.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing is Columbus was a city where the relationship between the black community and the student community and the Columbus police was steadily deteriorating during the later part of the 60s. The mayor of Columbus, Jack Sensenbrenner, was a Democrat and actually had supported Kennedy in 1960, but he was very much a law and order guy and was very supportive of the police. Interestingly enough, you had a fairly benign reaction here in Columbus after Dr. King was assassinated, and Columbus kind of congratulated itself for being so progressive. And it really wasn't. The relationships were deteriorating, and this city erupted into racial riots in the summer of 1969, just a year later. You also had a sit-in and then a takeover of the administration building by a group of black students in protest against the university's policies towards blacks. And that was settled peacefully. The students left voluntarily, but the university and the county prosecutor went after those students and charged 34 of them with kidnapping, which is a felony,
yeah,
a very serious offense. And there was a lot of blowback to that about, because there were white students that were involved in those protests as well, weren't charged, about differential enforcement against black students. 10 students were thrown out of the university. The case was later settled for much lesser charges, which to white people said, well, the justice system worked. To black people said, no, that meant the charges were absurd to begin with. And so you had a set of racial confrontations, which then over the next 2 years kind of festered.
And, well, there were so few blacks on campus as it was.
Yeah, there, proportionally, it was very few. But even at Ohio State, where you had only 2% blacks out of a 40,000 students, that would still be several hundred students. And they were becoming more outspoken as they felt the university wasn't doing enough to make them welcoming. There's a wonderful letter I found in the archives at OSU from two sociology professors who wrote in the summer of 1968 after the King assassination, the Kennedy assassinations, these events I talked about, and warned the university that if the students, the black students and the anti-war students who were unhappy with the way the university was treating them ever got together, they could close the university down.
Hmm.
The university ignored that letter. 2 years later, that's exactly what happened.
To its regret, I'm sure. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about 1968. We want to hear your memories. If you want to share them, 614-292-8513. You know, Alex Bloom, the actual topography of many cities changed during this period because of the rioting, because of the violence.
Well, in general, I mean, I think Bill says absolutely correct about the way in which a number of cities and places began to feel that that the answer to this was law and order and tougher questions, whether it was in cities or on university campuses. And the places, as was suggested, where this didn't happen is where there was much more humane and positive interaction. But this will begin to lead into changing the topography. It's a couple of years later when school desegregation and things begin to drive more whites out of the city as well, and also as the poverty programs decline. One of the things that King says in the summer of 68, in anticipation of the Poor People's March, which he never gets to, is that all the hope and enthusiasm that had come down literally from the federal government through the War on Poverty programs in the black communities in America was evaporating as the war in Vietnam began to supersede those things as well. And so this also adds to this antagonism. And I think in one place he even says, I wouldn't approve of, but I understand the motives why someone would make a Molotov cocktail. There is this sense of that, you know, the nation which had committed itself for 10 years to civil rights dating back to the middle 50s was now turning away and sending these kids to Vietnam. And I was going to ask Bill if those students who were suspended also then faced the draft, as he was talking about when he graduated. That was a kind of implicit threat based on if you were kicked out of school or even suspended for a semester, you could be, if you were male, you could be drafted. So it was an added sense of the state, the government, the city, the college coming down on individuals.
Good question.
Yeah, and the short answer is yes. If you got thrown out of school, you were draft bait.
If you failed one class, you were draft bait. Yeah. That was- Or dropped a class.
Kathy Schneider, I grew up in Michigan and was affected at the time by the riots in Detroit and Grand Rapids. And I think Benton Harbor had some problems as well. Did that kind of prime the pump for 68 then?
Yes. So one of the problems that most northern and western cities had is that when there was this wave of migration of blacks from the South, and in cities like New York and Chicago, also Puerto Ricans from the island, is that they were redlined into very poor, overcrowded housing conditions where the police would enforce segregation. And so police violence escalated, and police violence was the number one complaint when they studied and did a survey of people who had participated in riots. And the earlier riots, which were sparked by police violence, usually a police killing, sometimes a rumor of a police killing, most of the deaths in the riots were actually by police. And so Detroit, Chicago, Newark, these were some of the most bloody riots, but bloody because police killed hundreds of people. And so these communities were on edge. They were what Mayor Lindsay had called, you know, toxic, combustible areas where a single incident, especially an egregious incident, could act as a spark. And Martin Luther King's assassination did act as a spark.
I can't let you go, Kathy Schneider, before we talk about what happened at the Democratic National Convention.
Right.
That was a whole different visual for the television cameras. That was young, white, privileged youth revolting and being beaten up by cops all over the place. It was shocking. How did that change the tenor of all this?
Well, what it did do is give birth to a rainbow coalition. It helped create a coalition in Chicago between SDS and the Young Lords and the Black Panthers and the Young Patriots. And so there was a growing collaboration between young people of different races feeling equally victimized by police. It was something that concerned Hoover at the FBI, and so J. Edgar Hoover, and so he began the COINTELPRO, deliberately putting in agents provocateurs in these different organizations to create hostility between them and break the coalitions. But the Chicago convention showed what blacks in Chicago had been and Puerto Ricans in Chicago had been complaining about, which was quite how brutal the Chicago police were. And in fact, Mayor Lindsay had a huge argument with Mayor Daley about that, in which Lindsay said, "My police do not kill children."
How did that, Alex Bloom, change the, you know, seeing that on television is it was very different than anyone else had ever seen before.
Right, absolutely. I mean, that goes back in a way to what we were saying before. I mean, the chant of many of the demonstrators in Chicago was, "The whole world is watching."
Right.
The whole world is watching, which goes back to our sense of the technologically, you know, and so you'd have these images of the convention, which was already chaotic by the time we got to nomination night, when it was clear that Humphrey was going to win the nomination, inside the convention hall, with these massive marches and the police that was just been described on the streets. And so it becomes this sort of sense of it. I think I mean, in the direct way, it sort of reveals in some way to the American people who would used to be tuned in to watch conventions, kind of like just sort of a summer event every 4 years, see played out in front of them. And to the shock of, I think there's quotes from Walter Cronkite, who was otherwise this dispassionate, nonpartisan person, about what he was seeing on his monitors, as well as what he was seeing down on the convention floor, that echoed what American people thought. And then Cronkite was a sort of central figure in sort of articulating this moving sense away from this idea of being, is my country right or wrong, or the government doesn't make any mistakes. And I think it only adds to what we said before about disillusion with the political process, not just the convention, but also Humphrey wins the nomination without ever entering a primary. The enthusiasm of both the Kennedy and the McCarthy campaigns is smashed by the police as well as by the Democratic Party's structure. And so it ends up with a nomination, which Humphrey then calls a joyous moment that doesn't seem worth having.
Yeah, a little tone deaf. The reaction to those riots, Professor Schneider, did it have any effect on the ones that would come later in 69 and 70?
I don't think the Chicago Convention riot did, which was a police riot.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly the riots, the first riot of the 60s was 1964 in New York. And riots continued to crisscross the country for over a decade after. And I would say that it became a kind of repertoire in which that is how people acted out on who were victimized by their own police force, who were feeling completely unrepresented and were facing a police force that was supposed to protect and serve but was instead killing them and their children. And so riots became the way in which you exploded, especially in neighborhoods where older organizations had been overwhelmed by the new levels of migration, and there was not the ability to maintain a much more long-term organized strategy. Riots really were both spontaneous explosions and mimicking of repertoires that had been occurring elsewhere.
And can I build on that for a minute? The one of the difficulties of the 60s, there's a word they used back then called polarization. And people would sit and watch on TV these events happen, and younger, more liberal people would see a police riot and abuse of protesters. Older people, like my parents, would see that and say the police were totally justified. These kids are out of control. We need to do something. And where all this eventually led is to the horrible tragedy at Kent State.
Yeah.
And you just had a feeling where otherwise supposedly good-hearted people could look at the same event and come away with totally different conclusions.
I have an email from Mary Ann. She says, as someone who practiced duck and cover in grade school, graduated high school in 1968, and was on the OSU campus during the May 1970 riots, I thought my generation was unmatched in the U.S. for growing up in an environment of looming danger. Columbine and Sandy Hook and Parkland and all the other mass shootings have taught me different. We still had some sense of innocence in 1968 that today's kids are sadly missing. Even after Kent State, we had some sense that it couldn't happen again. Kathy Schneider, I have to say goodbye to you. I thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you very much. And I did want to add, it wasn't completely generational. I know my parents were certainly on the side of students and residents of ghettos during that time. There was a divide both at the older and younger generation politically. So it's not completely, it wasn't completely a generational issue as much as it was a political divide in the country.
Thanks again for joining us.
No, that's fine.
Kathy Schneider, Associate Professor in the School of International Service at American University and author of the book Police Power and Race Riots, Urban Unrest in Paris and New York. We're going to have more conversations if you want to join it, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the year 1968 and the mark it left on the world. 50 years ago, abortion was illegal. The working world was still largely separate and unequal. 12 women served in Congress, and not one served in President Lyndon Johnson's cabinet or on the Supreme Court. 1968 was a major turning point for women who left their homes and took to the streets, spreading their message of equality. Still with us is retired OSU Vice President for Business and Finance, author of Ohio State University in the 60s, The Unraveling of the Old Order, Bill Schicurti. Also with us by phone is Professor of History and Director of the American Studies Program at Wheaton College in Massachusetts, Alex Bloom. Joining us now, Washington Post Nationals feature writer Karen Heller, who recently wrote about the women's movement in 1968. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You wrote that 1968 was the year women took the message and the movement out of their homes and onto the streets. How long was the movement building at that point?
Well, you know, a lot of this came out of the civil rights and anti-war movements, which were already in, you know, full swing. This is often referred to as the second wave, the first wave being suffragettes, getting the right to vote. But many of the women I spoke to, and this has been written about, they felt that the anti-war movement in particular was very sexist and that it shut out women. So a lot of their activism came from prior activism where they felt they had no voice.
We hear the same sorts of issues regarding the civil rights movement, right?
Yes, that's correct. Although women actually have a better, you know, place. They were more prominent women in the civil rights movement. But the anti-war movement was, I mean, if you look at the Chicago, there were no women. And women were, you know, they were really treated as sex objects by much of the leadership in the anti-war movement.
Tell us about the climate of sexual discrimination and equality and inequality in 1968. Feminism wasn't a commonly known concept, at least not popularly known. Neither was sexism. Abortion was still completely illegal. The working world was separate, you know.
Right. Oh, absolutely. They were still ads. They were classified ads listed in newspapers and magazines where, you know, they were gender separated. They were, you know, they say looking for an attractive secretary. Maybe you'll marry your boss. Women who went to college, really the only choices even in 1968 were largely being, you know, executive assistants or, you know, teaching and nursing, you know, always historically female professions. And yet more women were going to college because of the baby boom. It was the beginning of the baby boom entering college, and colleges started to become, all male schools were becoming, you know, slowly going co-ed. But at that point, a lot of women were being, except for, you know, at OSU, at state universities, they were being educated with men, but many of the private schools were separated by gender.
Bill Schicurti, a lot changed at OSU very, very quickly. It's kind of shocking how different the experience was for men versus women.
Oh, absolutely. And especially at the beginning of the decade, where there were a whole set of rules that applied to women but not to men.
The curfews and so forth, yeah.
The apartment rule and all that kind of stuff. So the attempt to push those back actually started in 1960 and 61. The interesting thing is, and I think Karen's right about, in general, the anti-war movement was not open to women. Two of the major strike leaders and spokespersons here at OSU in 1970 were women. Lorraine Cohen and Joel Todd were among the leaders of that movement. So OSU in that regard was a little bit of an exception.
An anomaly, yeah. The consciousness raising groups were important in terms of planting the seeds of protest. Tell us about those, Karen Heller.
Yes. Well, you know, you just pointed out that was 1970. And 1968 is really the year that women got fed up and took to the street. They started with these consciousness-raising groups. This started in people's homes and then offices where they would talk about their abortions. They would talk about children they'd given up for abortions. And they really were sharing, you know, women having discussions and how could they mobilize. And the year began with a protest of women only against the war on Capitol Hill. And some of the younger women were very upset, but they felt they were marching as sisters and daughters and mothers and not as women. And that was, by the end of the year, they were marching on women's issues. They felt that they had to be heard, and they saw how the civil rights movement was going, and they were motivated. And the word, as you said, feminism was not in use, but a couple of women referred to it. But 68 is really the year you start to see this happen.
Alex Bloom, how big of a piece does the women's movement take up in your course on 1968?
Well, it has an extremely important piece. Everything that's been said is absolutely correct. But symbolically, is that a few weeks after the Democratic Convention in Chicago, the first major women's demonstration, at least in a public way that captured attention, at the Miss America pageant in Atlantic City. That September, the No More Miss America, which is sort of where the women's movement is announced to the public. It becomes, I mean, it's just picked up in the news and that, and all of that. And it's where, in fact, the misappropriated phrase bra burning comes from. There was meant to be this freedom trash can in which women were going to dump all the objects of their oppression, makeup and undergarments and all kinds of things, and then they were going to burn it. And actually, the officials asked them not to burn it because the boardwalk was wood, and they were afraid it would, catch on fire. But somehow that got picked up to be bra burners, which was a derogatory phrase for the women's movement and for feminists in this period as well. But if you look back at the No Miss America 10 declaration, they do talk about the things we would expect about exploitation and objectification, but also connecting it to the war that Miss America was part of the Bob Hope tour, connecting it to racial questions, that there had not been any non-white even finalists, let alone Miss Americas by that point. Mm-hmm. And it's a real awareness that it's connected to, as I suggested, these other 60s movements, but had its own sense as well. And I think it's absolutely right to suggest that in the next couple of years, we would see more and more women moving to the front, not just in the movements, but even, I think by 1972, there are women reporters on the floor from NBC and CBS News at the convention, joining the Dan Rathers and the John Chancellors, on the floor with the microphone, sticking there. You know, so just a couple of years later, things had changed dramatically.
Kieran Heller, what was that a situation then, that there was this explosion of demonstration in the 60s and 68, but this on the surface things seem to get better? Because now we have the Me Too movement, and we look back and go, what in the world?
Right. Well, in 68, as you pointed out, that protest was so important, they picked it because of the media. And it was the first time the war's women's liberation appeared in the press. They unfurled a banner. They bought tickets and went into the hall. And they intentionally chose only to speak to women reporters, because they wanted women reporters to not just be covering society and weddings, but to cover real news. Mm-hmm. So they were advancing that cause. They also, abortion became big. Abortion was not yet legal, but it would be. And, they were very interested in birth control and equal rights amendment. Now the National Organization of Women was in its early stages, but was working on, equal pay and also equal employment. So that just kept growing. And, the whole Ms. Magazine, launching of that, more and more now. They talk a lot. I interviewed a lot of women who were involved in the movement at that point. They talked about the rampant sexism that went on, and that was not addressed as much then as it is now, because they were really more interested in sort of equality in the workplace and the home.
Who are the icons that stand out for you as you looked back at this period, Kieran Heller?
Well, it's interesting. Some of the more famous women like Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem were not at this protest in Atlantic City. People like Shulamith Firestone, who is now deceased, and Susan Brown Miller. But they made a big point of not having leadership. It was really a group effort. It came from this consciousness raising, and they saw that as women, that they didn't want a hierarchical power structure.
Huh.
They wanted a shared community. That was really important, and many, many of them are still active. And the first wave of feminist historians, they all were activists, and many of them were activists in the 60s. And they like to see it that way. It's not one leader, but a group.
Did that strengthen them, or did that weaken them in any way?
I think it was a mixed blessing. I think in some ways it was hard to not always be, heard. And there are some women who are very resentful that certain women, became famous because of their media connections, or their books. But I also think it made more women feel they could have a role in the movement and decentralize it, that it wouldn't just be the New York media world. We tend to see women who are in New York as these leaders, but the movement was happening all over the country.
There's also questions about women of color and whether or not they were embraced by that larger movement.
Well, they tried hard. I mean, you know, Shirley Chisholm ran for president.
Yeah.
She's a feminist. And Flo Kennedy, who was this amazing lawyer, she was at the 1968, she's no longer with us, but she was at that 1968 protest. And there was also a Miss Black America. I interviewed the founder and the first Miss Black America, and they did that more because they were upset that there was no black presentation. That was more a beauty issue, and black is beautiful. And that pageant is still going on, by the way. And 2 years later, there was, I mean, this is sort of a different issue, but there was the first black contestant at Miss America. So,
and 50 years later, they finally got rid of the swimsuit competition.
That is correct. but after sexism, after it has always had male leadership until this moment, it really took exposure of how much sexism was in the pageant. And, you know, these emails were released that, you know, showed that they were, you know, saying unflattering things about the contestants, and now it's got all female leadership. But it took sort of shame and revelation to even get to that point.
Alex Bloom, when you're teaching these issues in your class on 1968, is it still a situation where the young women in your classes will say, well, you know, I mean, I did this on my own?
Well,
because that was the case when I was in college. There were a lot of young women saying, well, I didn't need the feminist movement.
Some. I mean, I think there's some of that. I mean, I think with every kind of movement that has some success, and we could discuss both the successes and the limitations mm-hmm. of what happened with the feminist movement, after a certain point, it feels very normal in that sense as well. Wheaton is one of those small liberal arts colleges that was described before, which was, when I first got there, a women's college. And then about 25, 30 years ago, it went co-ed. And so we still have a very strong sort of sense of support of the role of women and, you know, and the connectedness, the community of that as well. I think everybody, I mean, it's not just women. You can look at Clarence Thomas, who doesn't think he got to where he is based on anything other than his pure talent, when we know there was affirmative action that played a huge part in it as well. I think nobody wants to think they're not, their achievements are externally supported and not their own doing. But I think most women, when they start to think about it, especially ones who take courses or learn about this stuff, understand their connection to it.
I want to thank you, Alex Bloom, for joining us today. We're out of time already. I appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Alex Bloom, professor of history and director of the American Studies program at Wheaton College in Massachusetts. Karen Heller, thanks to you for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Karen Heller, national features writer for The Washington Post. She's written extensively about 1968. And Bill Schakerty, thanks again for joining us. Always appreciate your insights.
You're very welcome.
Bill Schakerty is retired OSU vice president for business and finance and author of the book Ohio State University in the 60s, The Unraveling of the Old Order. Thanks for listening today. And before I go, I want to welcome aboard our new senior producer, Mary Lee Williams. Thanks to Kyle McKinnon, our assistant producer, for holding down the fort all these weeks. That's it. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.